You know what I could do is I could clink my own glass, and then you won't have to move at all.
You know, I'm all about that lazy shit.
Okay.
What?
It's not a satisfying noise. Wait, what if I do it holding it?
That's not a satisfying noise.
It's not a satisfying smell.
Welcome back to Gumshoe Weekly,
the epicenter for murder, mystery, and man.
I'm your host, Brianna.
I'm your host, Fuck.
That should be your name. Just start doing F's now.
Fuck! Jonalise.
Jonalise.
I'm your host, Jonalise.
Okay.
I guess. That's something. You said it out loud. That's basically a name.
Welcome back, guys. We missed you.
We missed you.
It's almost like we didn't see you a week ago.
You don't know.
You don't know what I was doing. Did I see you? Did you see me?
Did we see each other? We see each other.
Alrighty.
Alright.
Do you have a question?
Oh, no. No. I don't.
Okay, I have a question. What is your go-to Super Smash Bros. Character?
Oh my god, so funny you said that. So I used to be really good at playing Robin when it was like me and my crew, and I would play with my other friend, and we would basically cheat because he was super amazing at it, and I was really bad at it. But he would like fly around and stuff, and I would do this one spell that would just make a huge flame go across, or like a beam, and it would just like punch everyone in the way. So he would just fight people while I charged it up, and then he would jump out of the way and I would hit everyone with it. And I made it to the end in a lot of games I should not have made it to the end in.
Well, that's good.
So that was my guy, but I recently tried to play it for the first time in literally 5 years, and I don't remember how to play that character anymore. So yeah, now I have no one. So I usually go with someone who I can make pink.
I've never played that game.
Really?
Yep.
That was an interesting question for you to ask, though.
I realized after I asked it, I wasn't asking about Mario.
What?
Because every time I see Super anything, I'm like, oh, Mario.
Oh my god. So who's your favorite Super Mario character?
I usually go for, like, one of the princesses or, like, one of the little weird characters, like Yoshi or the Mushroom Kid.
One time,
Dana, I want to say his name is Yogi, but that's not right.
It's not Yogi, it is Toad.
Toad, there you go.
Also known as Mushroom Kid, a.k.a. Yogi. My question for you is, what is your favorite sleepover activity?
Surprisingly, I haven't had a lot of sleepovers.
Okay. What would you like to do the most at a sleepover?
I like the idea of eating. That's like my favorite pastime.
Okay.
Food, I like the snacksage. But mostly I like just the talking part of it, I guess, like the gossiping part.
Oh my god.
You know when it's like real late at night and it's the lights are off?
Yes.
And you guys all get real, real, and you're like, oh my god, I killed a man once.
Oh my god, I killed a man once. Some of my best inside jokes came from that part of the night where you're all too delirious to keep talking to each other. I would say that I really like the talking part. I like when you do like s'mores and stuff like that. I also like when you like paint your nails and shit. That's fun.
Just goes to show you I've never really done a sleepover. None of my sleepovers have been that cute.
I guess.
All right, let's do this. Alrighty. Let's play rock, paper, scissors.
We didn't cut anything.
Not 20 minutes of anything.
Nothing. This episode is 8 minutes long so far. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Scissors. Paper. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Rock. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
Rock.
Scissors.
One and one.
Oh, okay. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Rock.
Rock.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Rock. Rock. Shoot, rock. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot, paper.
Rock. Motherfucker. I was going to do paper like an asshole. Motherfucker.
That was beautiful.
Who did you want to go first?
Me.
All right.
Me so I can stare at you in silence for 30 minutes afterwards. I'm going to earn this silence. Okay. So, this episode is our murderous episode.
Murder.
Yours is a murder, right?
Murder.
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 A murder most foul. Okay, so, do you want to hear about the most involved manhunt in British criminal history to this day?
British criminal history? Fuck yeah.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say American, because then, no. 2 10-year-olds, best friends, named Holly Marie Wells and Jessica Amy Chapman, went missing on August 4th, 2002. Here's a breakdown of what we know about the last day they were seen. Jessica Chapman left her house in Brook Street, Soham at 11:45 a.m., heading to Holly Wells' house in Red House Gardens for a barbecue. She played with a friend, Natalie Parr, and her best friend, Holly Wells, at the home, played games, listened to music, and did normal preteen things until Natalie left about a half an hour after Jessica arrived. So it's like 12:15 now, or like 12-something. Holly and Jessica continue to hang out, eventually changing into matching replica Manchester United jerseys, a football team, pretty famous one over there, around 3:15. They gather for dinner at 5:04 p.m., and Holly's mother takes a photo of the girls. They finish eating at 6:10, and the girls go back to Holly's room. 5 minutes after, they leave the house to buy candy from a vending machine at the local sports center. They fail to tell anyone at the house about this plan. Neither the guests or the other adults, because there were guests there because of the barbecue. Mm-hmm. At 8 p.m., Nicola Wells goes to her daughter's room to ask her to bid farewell to the rest of the guests that were attending the barbecue, but finds the room and house vacant of the 10-year-olds. In a panic, she and Kevin, Holly's father, search the house and the nearby streets. Once her 8:30 curfew is up, she calls the Chapmans to find out if they went there. But Leslie and Sharon Chapman had already been growing increasingly worried by Jessica's failure to come home. They keep searching in a panic for an hour and 25 minutes before reporting both girls missing at 9:55 p.m. The cops took this very seriously and dispersed 400 officers to do door-to-door interviews throughout Soham and searching the land with an overwhelming presence of volunteers. I said presence of local volunteers. I said that whole sentence like a robot. They were also assisted by U.S. Air Force officers stationed nearby. They released the photo of both girls in their Manchester United shirts through the media in hopes of getting reports of sightings. So, knowing the girls to be wary of strangers, they think that they could have been kidnapped and start questioning every registered sex offender nearby. This is now the next few days. Mm-hmm. 6 days later, on August 8th, CCTV of the girls at the sports center at 6:28 p.m. is released, which they use to reconstruct the last known movements and release that on the 10th. They receive upwards of 2,000 calls and tips, as well as a possible similar case of an unknown assailant with a green Ford Mondeo and stolen plates. This unsub had assaulted a 6-year-old the year before and followed a 12-year-old later with a different stolen plates on the same vehicle.
A 12-year-old, you said?
Mm-hmm. No, they followed a 12-year-old.
Oh.
It wasn't a 12-year-old driving. Oh. It had been seen...
That's what I thought.
It had been seen recently in Glatton, Cambridgeshire. Glatton, Cambridgeshire.
Gluten.
But sadly led to nothing. There were other helpful tips, i.e. sightings. Mark Tuck drove past the girls on Sand Street at 6:30 p.m., which would be 2 minutes after the CCTV footage. he saw their shirts and said, "Look, there's two Lil Beckhams out over there," to his wife. Karen Greenwood saw them walking arm in arm down College Road at 6:32, so that's 2 minutes after him. I think on the 12th, somebody reported seeing girls struggling with two young girls. Seeing someone's... I don't know. Yes.
It's all the tequila.
Girls... It literally says 12th. Girls struggling with two young girls.
Okay.
Somebody saw people... a man, I think, struggling with two young girls. But it ended up... I don't think that one panned out. And then later on, a jogger finds two mounds of fresh dirt, assuming that they are fresh graves. It ended up not being that, though. So
they dug them up.
They dug them up, and it was like, not wild boars, but it was like wild boars had been digging there. But not wild boars. But here we have wild boars, and that's the only animal I can think of.
Like a wild animal is.
Okay, just so you guys, like, have a little locality for Florida. When you see a bunch of, like, dirt all torn up in someone's yard in, like, such a way that it looks torn up, people who are local call it hog rootins.
Hog rootins?
Hog rootins.
Never heard of such
a thing. Hog rootins. Yeah, only the locals. And I know this because I do be hanging out with some locals. Some little redneck kids are like, I'm like, what happened to their yard? And they're like, hog rootins. That's what they call it. Wild boars. Hogs. Hog rootins. So anyways, in the interviews, they had a few notable people. They found out some more information from them. Ian Huntley, he spoke with the girls on his doorstep the day that they went missing. His girlfriend was their teacher, and they wanted to know if she got the full-time position that was open at their school. And then he said that they left towards Clay Street, which was, like, over a bridge. The cops there was a cop there, interviewing him.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that was a little bit suspect, so the
little girls went to the guy's house.
Yeah, and he was like, oh, my girlfriend was here. I was watching my dog. They talked to me, and then they went towards Clay Street. But something about the way that he had answered him, he thought was suspect. So, one cop investigated. He asked if he could see the house, and he came in. He saw no evidence, but he thought that it was odd that he had lots of clothes hanging on the drying line, even though it had been raining, which is very odd. Everyone knows that in the movies, they run out with a basket, and they're like, we have to get the clothing, it's raining. I don't know why I did an accent. But it's very fancy. And they run to get their clothing off the line because it's raining. And they mustn't get it re-wet. Or why would you have a line? So, he had a lot of clothes hanging on the drying line, even though it had been raining. The house was super clean. Huntley even said, excuse the dining room, we had a flood. And when he further asked him about things, he had an agitated demeanor.
Like, he was annoyed that they were asking questions?
Yeah.
Or, like, just me doing too much.
I think he was just annoyed that he was asking questions. So, following the disappearances, Huntley reluctantly did a bunch of television interviews.
What the fuck?
Because he was the last person to see them alive. And so he would give interviews about it, not really wanting to, but since he was the only one to see them alive. He also said that he had been holding on to a glimmer of hope that they'd be found safe and well. He thought that he'd been walking towards a local library. He had also participated actively in the search. So he also, would ask the officers what was going on, you know, if they found any DNA evidence,
like a killer?
If they, how long DNA evidence could survive before deteriorating.
Get the fuck out
of here. The regular run-of-the-mill questions. And they also had noticed, one officer had noticed three vertical scratches up his left jaw, which measured approximately 3 centimeters, but he said they were from his dog.
Alright.
In the interview, because they also interviewed the girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
In the interview, She corroborated the story that the girls had been on the doorstep visiting both of them. Mm-hmm. And she said, I only wished we had asked them where they were going. If only we knew then what we know now. Then we could have stopped them or done something about it. Further on,
sounds like a killer.
She's talking about the girls, and she's their teacher, so she knows them personally. And she does say, talking about Holly, because she had a drawing, a thank you card from Holly. Mm. So she said, she was just lovely, really lovely, referring to her in the past tense.
Yeah.
This is when they're still missing. And then she says, just get on the phone and come home, or if somebody's got them, just let them go. So they do continue questioning Huntley, and at one point he starts to lose weight and he has like symptoms of insomnia, and an officer, he even says to him, you think I've done it? I was the last person to see them. And then he starts crying. They continue to question those two throughout because something isn't sitting super right with them about the story and, you know, about their media statements.
Yeah.
So, they question them more, and then they place them in a safe house on the 16th.
Because people were, like, harassing them?
Yeah, I guess. And because they were the last one to see them, and whatever. So, this, you know, is a perfect time to ask the neighbors about them. One neighbor says that before they return to their house at College Close, that's what, like, the house is called.
Mm-hmm.
The neighbor of the mom of the girl's Rob, fuck her mom, Carr's mom. She observed the couple standing at the rear of the vehicle of his car with the trunk open. And, she said that Huntley was pale and shaking and he just stared into the trunk. Sorry, it says boot and everything. In the trunk for several minutes while Carr stood alongside him, and she looked like she had her head down and was maybe crying.
Mm-hmm.
But when he realized that the neighbor was watching them, he closed the trunk immediately.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It was the day after they went missing.
Mm-hmm.
So, upon questioning other neighbors, they also say that one reveals that several years ago, Ian Huntley had been accused of rape. And the other people point out that they were pretty sure that Carr was in Grimsby and not home per her alibi.
Oh.
They were like, well, she got home the day after.
Yeah.
But the day of, she was not there.
Oh, you scandalous wench.
And the whole alibi is that they were there to visit her.
Mm-hmm.
So, while in the safe house, the police searched their house and his job.
And his job?
Yes. So every room was recently thoroughly cleaned. Thoroughly.
Bleach?
Mm-hmm. They found numerous items that were of major importance to the investigation, which they still keep as private.
Oh,
no. And then at the school, they found clothing the girls were last seen in.
What the fuck? At the school?
At the school where he worked. Sorry, he worked as a groundskeeper at another school.
Oh.
So they found clothing that the girls were last seen in. It was charred and cut up, but it was the jerseys that they had been photographed in that they had been seen in.
Yeah.
And the prints and fibers around the trash and where they had been, because they found them in an old trash bin,
mm-hmm.
matched him. So, they searched his car, which had also been recently cleaned, but they found brick dust, chalk, and a concrete mixture around the wheels and pedals.
Mm-hmm.
The cover from the rear seat was missing, and the trunk lining had recently been removed and replaced with a house carpet.
What the fuck?
Yes. Upon finding the clothing, Huntley and Carr were placed under arrest at 4:30 on the 17th. At this point, the girls are missing for 13 days. Ian exhibited a lot of odd behavior, being evasive, confused, emotionally detached, and even drooling to try to imply that he had mental illnesses.
Wow.
So they did a psych evaluation on him. Carr, however, immediately confessed to lying about the alibi, even stating that on the phone he'd said, "The thing is, Maxine, they came in our house." He'd said, yes, He'd said Holly had a nosebleed and came in to stop the nosebleed. They had stopped there to inquire about Maxine.
Yeah.
And she got a nosebleed, so he brought them in. Jessica sat on their bed as he helped Holly. This is his thing. Jessica sat on their bed and he helped Holly, and then they left. He reminded her of the 1998 rape that he had committed, but she thought,
why is this little girl sitting on your bed?
I know. The 1988 rapes he had committed, but she had thought up until now were false accusation. And he told her that he was worried about being accused of being involved and that the previous arrest gave him a nervous breakdown. So this is what caused her to be his alibi. Mm-hmm. She said, he can have been. It can have been. He hasn't done it. That's what she said when they told her that it was him.
Solid.
Yes. So, because she, again, the cops are like, that was not an accusation. It was a reel.
It was a reel.
So at 12:30 p.m. on the 17th, gamekeeper Keith Pryor finds the girls lying side by side in a 5-foot-deep irrigation ditch by a pheasant pen that was near the Lakin Heath Royal Air Force Station, 10 miles east of Soham. He noticed a smell coming from the area a few days earlier, and he came back on the 17th to find the source of it. Mm-hmm. The decomposition. Have you ever seen that post that was like, I found this dog wandering around my neighborhood, and I brought it home, like, and put up ads for to find it? And they were like, on its name tag was no contact information, but just the word donkey. They were like, and we were calling him it for days until we figured out through a series of events that he only answers if you say it in a Shrek voice. And they were like, and I almost don't want to meet the person this dog belongs to. Donkey! The fact that that's the only way your dog will answer means you say it like that every time.
That's fucking hilarious.
Yes. 100% it is. Okay.
Donkey!
The decomposition was advanced and had been partially burned. They did ID them, though, and ascertained that they didn't die in the location they were found in. Mm-hmm. They also found some of Jessica's hairs on a nearby branch. So the cause of death was hard to determine, but they said that it was most likely asphyxiation, mm-hmm. and that they looked like they were dumped within 24 hours of their death. So there were bent nettles nearby.
Nettles?
Nettles, yeah. Nettles are a plant. You know that? Okay.
No.
Nettles.
No.
Nettles. It was bent nettles nearby. Mm-hmm. The nettles were... It was nettles shoots.
Okay.
So, they bring in Patricia Wiltshire. So, she analyzed the shoots. She noticed that the new side shoots on the section of the nettles leading into the ditch, she identified that as a path that the killer took into the ditch.
Okay.
They only grow if a plant has been trampled on, and she was able to work out that the nettles had been stepped on 13 and a half days before, soon after the girls went missing. She also established that pollen from his shoes in his car exactly matched the type found in the ditch near Lakin Heath where the girls' partially burnt bodies had been discovered.
Damn, girl.
Yes. So she analyzed all of those things, and that is what nailed him. That is what caught him. And then slowly, everything crumbled. So they also found minute traces of blood and saliva upon their clothing. A scientist named Helen Davey said that there were a lack of traces of semen, which could have been a result of the charred and melted conditions of the clothing she had inspected. Mm-hmm. They also found traces of blood spattering about the hallway and main entrance to the master's bedroom. So, he defended himself in court.
I love those guys.
I love those guys.
Those guys are the best.
Yes, bitch. Okay. Do you want to hear the story of why he said it all went down?
Of course.
I'm going to tell you. Okay, so here's what he did. He admitted they died in his house, but denied that either death had been intentional. So he said that Holly and Jessica had entered his bathroom to stem a mild nosebleed. when the girls walked by his home. That had occurred when the girls walked by his home. The bath was already filled with water as he'd been cleaning his dog. They also say cleaning his dog instead of washing. In the bathroom, he had slipped and accidentally knocked Holly into the bath while helping her stop her nosebleed. And this caused her to drown as he himself had panicked and froze, his words.
But a 10-year-old girl can't get out the tub if she fell inside of it?
Yes. So, he further claimed that Jessica witnessed the accident and began screaming, "You pushed her!" And that he then accidentally suffocated her while attempting to stifle her screaming. That preoccupied him, so he couldn't help Holly out of the bath because he was stopping Jessica from screaming. So at this point, he's accidentally killed both of them. And then he says that his first coherent memory had been of sitting in his vomit-stained landing close to Jessica's body. They called them accomplished liars. They said that him and Maxine, because even though Maxine didn't do it, she fucking lied for him. They said that it was a cynical deception. They said that she only revealed her lies when the police told her that they found the bodies. And that they were like, their thing was, you were just going to keep lying. The lawyer going against Huntley had said, "We invite you to reject the accounts of both deaths being accidental as desperate lies, the only way out for him. We suggest that this whole business in the house was motivated by something sexual, but whatever he initiated plainly went wrong. Therefore, in this ruthless man's mind, both girls had to die of his own selfish interest." And then he had also said, "We pose this question, two of them? In that case, we would have to consider Huntley's behavior over the fortnight between the girls' disappearance and their bodies being found." Saying, like, he's obviously not confused. He seemed very clear on everything. Just a little background on him. We know he raped a few people, which is what they think was his motive had been, was that he wanted to rape them. And then it just got, like, out of hand. So, he apparently had done... Between 1992 and 2002, he had sexually assaulted a lot of women and children, which he didn't have any sort of legal repercussions on any of those. The youngest had been 12 years old, and he had attempted to rape an 11-year-old, too.
Jesus Christ. What a dick.
Yes. It all kind of added up, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But he's in jail now. And she went to jail for, I think, 3 years, but she still tried to, like, write him letters and stuff.
Bitch.
Yeah. And then I think eventually she gave up, but also we could be wrong. Well, and that's how analyzing nettles solved two murders.
That's pretty dope.
Just some weeds.
Not dope that there was a murder, but dope that it was solved mm-hmm. by a badass chick who likes flowers. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. She was sick AF. There was like a bunch of articles. Oh, I got my information from Wikipedia and I found it originally on Cracked and TheGuardian.com. All right, it's finally your turn.
Yep. Alrighty. Well, I finished my whole glass of wine.
Ooh, I'm gonna finish mine.
So.
Perfect.
Let's see if I can do this.
Fuck yeah. You need to be topped off?
Our story.
Starothy.
Our story. Fuck. All right, I'll just get right into it.
Get into it.
Dorothy Jane Scott was a 32-year-old woman living in Stanton, California with her aunt and 4-year-old son. She was a single mother working as a back office secretary for two stores. In some articles it said she was like a co-owner, but I don't know if that's accurate. One called Swinger's Psych Shop, which sold, like, lava lamps and beads and stuff like that, and the other was Custom John's Head Shop, which is just, like...
A weed shop,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I had to look it up. I've never heard it referred to as that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They have some here. That's the only reason I know about it. My dad...
We always called them smoke weed. Shops.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
While at work, her parents, who just lived in Anaheim a couple of blocks from her job, would babysit Sean, her son.
I've been there.
And every evening, Dorothy would pick her son up from her parents' home and drive the 20 minutes back to her home. Would cook dinner and then watch cartoons with Sean or read him a book. She was also, like, a devout Christian and did not drink or do drugs and only occasionally dated. Her dad added she had no steady boyfriends that she knew of. She was described as a homebody by both friends and co-workers. So, let's find out what happened to Dorothy. Mm-hmm. Our story begins on the night of May 28th, 1980, around 9 p.m.
It's the worst year.
Yeah. Dorothy, like usual, dropped off Sean at her parents' and went to work. She had a meeting at work, and it was during this meeting when she noticed that her co-worker, Conrad Bostrom, looked ill and had a red mark on his arm. The mark on his arm was red and swollen, so she knew it was serious and needed medical attention. So Dorothy and another co-worker, Pam Head, decided to leave the meeting so they could take Conrad to the emergency room at UCI Medical Center, where it was determined that he had been bitten by a black widow spider.
Oh!
Yeah. So, on their way to the emergency room, Dorothy stopped at home to check on her son and changed her scarf from a red one to a black one. She told her parents she would be out and didn't know when she would be back. Pam and Dorothy stayed in the waiting room together, not really leaving each other's side at any point that Pam could remember. And once Conrad was just discharged around 11 p.m., Dorothy offered to drive her car around to pick him and Pam up at the door because he still didn't look up to the long journey back to the car. So Pam and Conrad filled his prescription and went back to Dorothy. When she still hadn't picked them up after nearly 20 minutes, they went out to the parking lot to try and find her. Suddenly, they saw Dorothy's white 1973 Toyota station wagon speeding towards them. They waved their arms to get her attention, and her headlights were on full beam, blinding them, so they couldn't see who was behind the wheel. The car sped past them and took a sharp right turn out of the parking lot. They thought something had come up with her son, and that was the reason for the hasty departure. However, a few hours later, after not hearing from Dorothy, Pam and Conrad called her parents to ask if they had seen her, but she had not shown up to pick up her son from their house yet. Pam and Conrad eventually called the police to report her missing. This was very unlike her. She was described as organized and dependable. She was also a great mom, very caring and deeply committed, so you could see their concern. The police didn't seem very concerned, though, seeing as she was an adult.
Oh, that's the worst.
So at around 4:30 a.m. on May 29th, about 5 hours after Dorothy was last seen, her car was discovered in an alley in Santa Ana, nearly 10 miles from the hospital. Whoever had taken it had set it on fire.
Oh.
This would now catch the attention of the police.
Oh, yes.
A week later, an unknown man called Vera Scott, Dorothy's mother. The caller asked, "Are you related to Dorothy Scott?" "Yes," Vera answered. "I've got her," he said, before quickly hanging up.
Okay. Was it publicly known that she was missing at that point?
I don't think so.
I've got her.
This wasn't the first time the mysterious phone calls would be made to the family. Several months before her disappearance, Dorothy began receiving terrifying phone calls from an unknown man. While she did recognize the voice, it was likely an acquaintance with whom she had only exchanged a few words with.
Oh.
What the man spoke about on the phone differed from call to call. Sometimes he would tell Dorothy how much he loved her and wanted to be with her.
Oh.
Other calls, he told her he wanted to kill her.
Oh.
The scariest was that his obsession with Dorothy went beyond harassing her on the phone.
Oh, no.
He took it a step further, describing in detail to her about herself describing to her details about herself that only someone who was following her would know.
No.
For example, her daily routine and what she was wearing.
Okay.
Vera described one call in particular that really rattled her daughter, in which the unknown caller told her he wanted to chop her up into bits so that no one would ever find her.
Oh my god.
The calls justifiably scared the crap out of Dorothy. She no longer felt safe at home or at work, knowing there was a dangerous and clearly crazy person tracking her every move. Just a week before her disappearance, she began taking karate lessons, and she was also considering buying a gun.
Okay, that's fair.
The calls from this man to Dorothy's mother would continue nearly every Wednesday for the next 4 years.
No!
He never grew tired of taunting Vera, and the calls were usually short and usually occurred when Vera was home alone. They were always along the lines of, "I have Dorothy," or "I killed her." Mm-hmm. He went as far as to learn the schedule of the family. But he slipped up once and called at night, not getting Vera, but instead Jacob. This, which was Dorothy's father. This stopped the Coles, but only for a while. Police told Dorothy's parents to keep the details surrounding the disappearance quiet. And this is so when someone is brought in, they don't know all the details from reading them in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
So if a suspect can tell details of the crime that only the investigators know, they're likely to be the one who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jacob, Dorothy's father, was tired of keeping it quiet.
Oh.
He called the registered newspaper in Santa Ana, who then ran a story about Dorothy's disappearance, and the same morning that the story ran, the manager editor, Pat Riley, received a phone call that said, "I killed her. I killed Dorothy Scott. She was my love. I caught her cheating with another man, and she denied having someone else. I killed her." This anonymous call has details and information that someone who was closely involved in the case and disappearance would know. For instance, the night of her disappearance, she was wearing a red scarf, and the man she had brought to the hospital was suffering from a spider bite. Only somebody who's watching you or the two people you know would know that.
Yeah.
This call to the managing editor left everyone baffled, both police and family. Dorothy didn't have a boyfriend they knew of. She worked two jobs and was raising her son, so where was the time for a secret boyfriend?
Yeah.
The caller was clearly unhinged. Police did try chasing his call, but he never stayed on the line long enough, and the case eventually went cold.
Oh.
So after 4 years of being a cold case, the calls continued, on August 6th, 1984, human bones were discovered lying side by side with dog bones. About 10 meters from Santa Ana Canyon Road in a remote construction site.
Side by side.
Yeah. The bones were partially charred, and from the looks of it, had been there for 2 years already. But a bushfire had gone through the site 2 years prior. A turquoise, which probably resulted in the charring of the bones.
Mm-hmm.
A turquoise ring and watch were also found. And on August 14th, the bones were identified as Dorothy Scott's by dental records. An autopsy was performed and could not determine the cause of death. Dorothy's mother said that the watch had stopped at 12:30 a.m. on May 29th, about an hour after Pam and Conrad last saw her car.
Mm-hmm.
So the time stopped exactly when they stopped seeing that she was last spotted.
Mm-hmm.
So, to this day, no one has been charged or named a suspect with the disappearance of Dorothy. For a short while, Sean's father, Dennis Terry, was looked into, but at the time of her disappearance, he was in Missouri, so he had a solid alibi.
Yeah, yeah.
There was talk of another man who lived across the street from the shops that were owned, and it was spoke about that he, like, kind of showed some interest in her, but they really think of this guy as, like, a scapegoat. They were just looking for anybody to charge with the murder. But the fact that he was a little, off-putting, he was, like, considered a weird character.
Oh, yeah, of course. And they're like, oh, it's them.
Yeah, so I didn't really see very much about him in any of the articles.
Uh-huh.
Mostly just the fact that she went missing.
Mm-hmm.
There was no talk of, like, who it could be or who this person was. And I didn't read anything about the phone calls ever stopping.
Right, yeah.
Or even starting again.
Yeah.
And that's the story at the fuck me.
That's the story.
That's the story of Dorothy Jane Scott.
That was really good.
Thanks.
Short and sweet, just the way I like it.
Yeah.
Just like you.
Short and a little bitter.
Short, a little bitter, mostly sweet.
Yeah. Depends who you ask.
Thanks for joining us again, new and returning listeners.
Welcome.
We
and goodbye.
Care for you deeply.
Why do we always get weird at this part?
That's so weird.
It's like we don't know how to say goodbye.
It's a rule. Thanks for joining us. And if you would like to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at
Gumshoe Weekly.
On Facebook at
Gumshoe Pod.
And you can email us suggestions or anything at
GumshoeWeekly@gmail.com.
We love doing listener suggestions. They're personal fave.
Yep, yep, yep. Don't forget to share.
Don't forget to share. Share with your friends. Share with your dad.
Yep.
Is he single? Let us know.
No. Well, no. Bye.
Let me know.
No.
No. Don't let Brianna know.